The views and comments expressed on the Space Show by its guests, callers, and listeners belong to them. The Space Show and its hosts serve only as a platform and are not responsible for others' comments or views. All topics discussed on the Space Show are primarily for educational purposes.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other thing. Not because they are easy, but
we
because
have
they
main
are
engine
hard.
Start. 4, 3, 2, 1.
It's the Space Show with Dr. David Livingston, broadcasting to 7 continents, consistently bringing you quality news and interviews with the best and brightest minds in the new space economy. Here is the founder and host of the Space Show, the man who best articulates the vision of space commercial enterprise, Dr. David Livingston.
And good afternoon, everybody. Welcome to the Monday Space Show program. I am your host, David Livingston. Thanks for tuning in today. A couple of quick announcements and on to our program. For those of you who would like to give us a call and talk with our guest today, Eric Seathouse, it is toll-free 1-866-687-7223. And email is drspace@thespaceshow.com. And that is also our website, thespaceshow.com. So while you're there, there is a very detailed newsletter that we upload to the Space Show website on Sunday after the Sunday Space Show program. It has all of the current information on it for this week. Each week we update it. And it's the only place where we have a future events section, what's in store for you on the Space Show in coming weeks. Plus, if we have to modify our schedule at all, this is where we do it. That does happen from time to time. So if you tune in and you're not hearing the program you think you should be hearing, please check the website newsletter because that explanation and when the original guest will be rescheduled will probably already be there waiting for you to take a look at it. And then everything we do is archived, and you can listen right off of our website, easily download the program. And you can do the same at our blog, thespaceshow.wordpress.com. And on the blog, you can, of course, exchange notes with other listeners as well as with the guest. And then there is a Space Show store. Look up toward the top. You'll see Space Show gear. And also the Support the Space Show button, which I believe is the most important button there because that allows us to continue with our funding, and our funding keeps us on the air. So you will see it there. Remember, if you're a U.S. federal taxpayer, you do get a deduction for your gift. And the same is true if you're a California taxpayer, as we're a California public benefit corporation. We also have a very short email newsletter that we send out early Monday morning, California time, via email. If you want your name added to it, please send us your email address, and we'll be happy to do so. It's very short. I promise it won't clutter up your inbox. And that is the email newsletter that we do send out. Then there's a guest search tool that I want to call your attention to on the website. And this is a list chronologically of all of our programs since 2001. The newest are on top. And you can do global searches for keywords for your favorite guest or topic like Mars or Virgin Galactic, like we're going to talk about in part today with Dr. Seathouse. Just about anything you want, space tourism, SLS, reusable rockets. When you find all the shows where that key search word is a substantial part of the programming, then write down the dates and you can then pull those shows up on our Space Show search engine on our homepage as it searches by date. When we're able to develop our new website, which I've been talking about in recent weeks, we will have a searchable database. And you won't have to go through this multi-step process to search our database and to get the information that you want. Please do remember that we podcast, and we thank gigadial.net for that podcasting service. Our RSS URL, if you want to subscribe, is on our website and our newsletters, both of them, the email newsletter as well as the longer website newsletter. We are trademarked and copyrighted. And we allow you to download our shows and share them and pass them around on the net. Either you can actually pass a full show around if you want to do that, or you can send the URL to somebody who wants to hear the show, and they can just pull it up themselves. There are some rules that we do enforce. Don't do anything commercial with the shows. Do not edit the shows. Do not do so for your personal use or to upload on any other website, including YouTube. So no cuts, nothing like that. And then written transcripts are not permitted, even if they're for your own personal use. There is a full copyright disclosure statement that I urge you to pay attention to. It is on all of the website pages for both the spaceshow.com and our parent 501c3 One Giant Leap Foundation.com. I have reported companies to YouTube for violating our copyright, and you don't want to get involved in that. All you need to do is email me with what you want to do and why and what the cut is or clip is that you want to make, and let's see if we can work it out. But don't just go and do it, because we do our best to enforce our copyright. And I urge you to pay attention to what we have said on our website, on both of our websites, One Giant Leap and The Space Show. Please do also remember that we are partially sponsored by the Secure World Foundation, and they promote cooperative solutions for space security. For more information, visit their website, which is www.swfound.org. And they also do sponsor our webinar series, and we're deeply appreciative of that with them. Our guest today is returning guest, Eric Seedhouse. And Dr. Seedhouse, who has been on the space show as many times as books he has written, because he's really a prolific author, has worked as an astronaut training consultant for Bigelow Aerospace in 2005, a company for whom he wrote the Space Flight Participant Flight Surgeon's Manual. He has also developed astronaut training protocols for future spaceflight participants, and he wrote and edited several chapters of Bigelow Aerospace's Astronaut Training Manual. He is a research scientist specializing in environmental life sciences and physiology, the subject in which he obtained his Ph.D. in physiology while working for the European Space Agency between 1996 and 1998. In 2009, he was one of the final candidates for selection as an astronaut with the Canadian Space Agency's astronaut recruitment campaign. His full bio is on the Space Show website. That gives you an idea of who he is. And as I said, he is a most prolific author with really great books dealing with different aspects of commercial and entrepreneurial space. Eric, welcome back to the show. How are you?
All right. Thanks for having me back, David.
Always a pleasure. And you just got back from ISDC in Toronto, correct?
Yeah, I was giving a talk about the parallels between polar exploration and going to Mars. And then on the back of that, I got invited, all expenses paid, to the Shackleton Museum in Ireland in October, because the Shackleton Museum has an annual conference, a four-day conference, and they invite speakers from around the world, polar explorers and all sorts of speakers. And this year they're inviting me on the back of that book, because the guy who runs the Shackleton Museum picked up the book and thought he was surprised at how many parallels there were between what Shackleton went through and what Mars astronauts will go through. So that'll be interesting.
Now, which book specifically is this?
It's called Survival and Sacrifice, and what we know about polar exploration and how it applies to Mars.
So I'm not familiar with that book. Is that one out already?
Yeah, that's the one Norris should have. She said she sent you the e-copy of that in the beginning of May.
Well, as we know,
but anyway.
So I'm missing that in the Virgin Galactic book via email. She may have sent them, but I don't know where the emails went. Sometimes they disappear into the ether, Eric, and never to be seen again. Very, very weird. Are there a lot of parallels with going to Mars and polar exploration?
Yeah, because the first trip to Mars will be a survival exercise. That's what it will be. That's the only goal. You survive the trip. And that's pretty much what Shackleton and Nansen and Amundsen and Scott and all these famous explorers were setting out to do when they left on their expeditions, you know, over 100 years ago. I mean, the first goal was to survive. The second goal was to either go to the South Pole or find the Northwest Passage or do whatever they were supposed to do. But the primary goal was survival. And that's why there's probably very little need for these analog missions that we keep hearing about, such as the Mars 500, because if you go to the library and pick out one of these books, such as Endurance or South, these polar explorers kept very, very detailed diaries And so you can learn a lot about the psychology and the crew management and things like that just by reading these diaries.
But when we hear human spaceflight missions talked about by Mars advocates of various degrees, we don't hear it described as a survival mission.
Well, it is, because you look at all the things they have to go through. I mean, the radiation environment, I mean, we know that's a mission killer to start with. The bone demineralization, muscle atrophy, we've got cataracts, we've got vision impairment, which we know now because of the long-duration astronauts. I mean, it just goes on and on and on. So, I mean, you just the first 6 months getting there, it'll be a survival exercise, never mind the trip on the surface and getting back. Just those first 6 months will be an exercise in survival.
We certainly don't hear that from Mars One, or as I said, the other Mars advocates. My impression is that they believe when they go, they will have met and successfully addressed most of these challenges.
Well, that's being very optimistic. I mean, I was at ISDC, and the speaker after me, Logan, I can't remember his first name, NASA engineer for 26 years, and he was agreeing with me when I thought, because I alluded to the irradiation problem in my talk, and he gave some examples. He's an engineer, so he gave some examples of the thickness of the water wall that you would need to provide the same environmental protection that we have here on Earth. You'd need a water wall 10 meters thick. 10 meters thick. So you imagine the cost of providing a water wall 10 meters thick, talking several millions of liters of water to create a radiation shield around the spacecraft. It's just not going to happen. We can talk about liquid hydrogen, we can talk about magnetic fields until the cows come home, but these technologies aren't at much more than TRL level 5 or 6. I mean, they have a long way to be before we can develop those technologies until they're proven and field tested. So, the Mars One can, you know, do some crystal balling and look into the future, but, I mean, they really don't have an idea of when they're going to solve this radiation problem, and that's just one problem.
Okay, so 10 meters thick, that's 30 feet roughly.
Yeah, and if you, another example he gave was to give the same radiation protection as someone at 18,000 feet altitude here on Earth, you'd need a water wall 5 meters thick.
Well,
if you were to give you an example, the Mars 500 analog, that was, I think, 20 feet by 5 feet. I can't remember the exact dimension. But if you were to take that as the size of the vehicle that was to go to Mars, you were to just give it 1 meter of water protection, you're looking at 1.3 million liters of water you'd need to haul up into low Earth orbit and wrap it around that spacecraft. I mean, you look at the cost of ferrying just 1 kilogram or 1 liter of water to low Earth orbit now, and you can just do the math. I mean, it's just not going to happen.
Well, I mean, even Elon talks about going to Mars, but he didn't talk about taking that much water with him as a shield. So do they really, I guess they believe there's going to be plastic shields or electromagnetic shields or something by the time they're ready to go.
Yeah, I mean, you can talk about polyethylene. I mean, that's a great material to use for radiation shielding, but it's not a very good material to make spacecraft out of. And polyethylene is great because it's hydrogen-based, and hydrogen is a large molecule, and you want large up molecules to protect you from radiation. But at the end of the day, you're going into a deep space environment. And we know from Curiosity, because Curiosity took along a radiation assessment detector, which was switched on all the way, and it measured the deep space environment. And what they found was just bad, 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 bad news, because based on that, it would increase the astronaut's risk of cancer by 5%, and that exceeds NASA's 3% criterion.
Well, I wish you were on tomorrow night with Dr. Zubrin, because I'm quite sure he would not be particularly supportive of these kinds of radiation issues.
Well, these are the facts. I mean, black and white. I mean, you can sugarcoat it and you can cherry pick the data all you want to make your case, but at the end of the day, you go to Mars with the technology we have now, and you're taking body bags along. Simple as that.
Except the last person isn't going to be able to get into a body bag unless they do it while they're still alive. So,
well, that's right. We'll have to think about that from a human factors perspective.
that would be a trick, right? The audience reaction to hearing this, I'm curious, because this is a pretty much an advocate type of conference, and they're pretty gung ho to want to do these big vision projects like going to Mars and other things. Were they were they dismissive of it, or what was the reaction?
Well, I mean, like I say, like I said, we're big Mars advocates. We want to go to Mars, I mean, it's the cutting edge of exploration, but you can't argue with the facts. I mean, this guy's an NASA engineer. He's worked for NASA for 26 years. He presented the facts very, very straightforward, very concisely. I mean, you can't argue with that. And this is just one mission killer. Radiation is just one mission killer. It's probably the biggest one. I mean, we haven't got to entry, descent, and landing yet, but, I mean, you look at all the physiological mission killers. Even if you could solve those, you still have the EDL problem to think about, and that's a long way before we solve that, a long, long way.
I wish you could talk to people who say they're going to be doing these Mars missions, like Elon and others. I'd love to. They have a little earphone there to hear these conversations, because why it's hard for me to understand why they keep promoting something that is not very doable in spite of the facts, and I don't think they're ignorant of the facts. I think they know the facts, but somehow they're dismissive. I just don't get it.
Well, those are the fanatics you're talking about, David. I mean, gradually people are coming around to the fact that, yes, we have to go back to the moon to use that as a field test or a test bed for the technology we need to take along to Mars. I mean, that's the rationale right now, because Mars is not doable. It just isn't with the technology we have now, or the technology we'll have in 10 years, maybe in 20 or 30 years, but certainly not in the next 10 years. So, and that's the general consensus now. You talk to people at these conferences, we're not talking about the Mars fanatics now, we're talking about, you know, rational people who understand the technology, who understand the hurdles, who understand the challenges, and the consensus is that, yes, we have to go back to the moon.
I have a phone ringing, but I don't believe that's... I'm wondering if that's my toll-free line. Hold on a minute. Let's find out if that's the toll-free line. No, it's not the toll-free line, so I don't know. I don't know what that line is. So, tell me something. Your sense of a reasonable timeline with reasonable funding, which there's no funding that's reasonable anymore, but reasonable funding and reasonable timeline with technology development to go to Mars. When do you think it could happen?
I mean, unless Elon Musk has something up his sleeve, because I know he's going to be talking about this at the end of the year, about his Mars Colonial Transporter and how he's going to get people to Mars. Unless he's got some miracle that we haven't heard of, then I think we're looking at least 30 years down the road. But Mars has always been a 30-year problem. In the 1970s, it was 30 years. In the 1980s, it was 30 years. In the 1990s, it was 30 years. So, I mean, me saying it's going to be 30 years down the road, probably being very, very optimistic. Very optimistic.
30 years, you're saying.
I mean, if you look at the extrapolation of... how we're going to develop the technology, if you look at the extrapolation of how we're going to solve the physiological problems, then you're probably looking at 30 years, the thick end of 30 years.
You have an email from Doug in Southern California, and he says, Eric, even Dr. Jim Logan doesn't end up saying that 10 meters of water shielding is necessary to go to Mars. His article with Dan Adamo ends up saying that only about 50 centimeters of water would be necessary during Mars transit. That's 1/20th of a 10-meter wall, and according to their paper, comes to about 80 tons of water. That amount could be launched in a single SLS rocket.
That's right. I didn't say that. What Jim Logan said was, to give an example of the problem, if you wanted to be absolutely safe, if you wanted to provide as much protection as you have here on Earth, that's how much water you would need. And what Doug said is right, because that's the amount of water that you would need just to come within the NASA limits of the 3% excess cancer risk.
So is the guy that you heard at ISDC, is it Dr. Jim Logan?
I think it might be, yeah.
So he's an MD, not an engineer.
Is he?
He's a retired medical doctor.
Okay.
If we're talking about the same one, he's on the space show all the time, and I've heard him say many times, but he doesn't talk about 10 meters of water shielding, so...
Well, no, but like I said, that's if you wanted the same protection as you have here on Earth. I'm not saying that's what you need to go to Mars. If you wanted to be absolutely safe and get the same protection here on Earth, That's how thick it would have to be. But 5 meters would be give you the protection of somebody at 18,000 feet altitude. And then the amount that Doug said, which I know I've spoken with Doug, and he's absolutely right. That's how much you would need to get them to get the astronauts underneath the NASA limit, which is the 3% increasing cancer risk limit.
Okay. Doug, thank you for that clarification, and you too as well, Eric. So what does this do for the human spaceflight efforts to go to Mars? Does it sidetrack going to Mars or defer going to Mars to focus the development on going to the moon, or is there still a track saying we can go directly to Mars? I'm kind of confused here as to where the market and where the research and where the policy is going to take us.
Well, the thing is, there is no policy. NASA hasn't got a policy. European Space Agency hasn't got a policy. Neither of those agencies have a policy of going to Mars. They haven't set that as a goal. And so what we're left with is commercial enterprises such as Shackleton Energy Company and Shimizu and companies like that who are setting up on their own and planning on going to the moon to establish commercial operations there. So hopefully if they're successful, then that will lead as part of a test bed, because even something like ISRU, in-situ resource utilization, we have no idea how to deal with that on the moon, never mind Mars. I mean, you look just look at the dust environment. I mean, how do we manufacture equipment that can work doing ISRU activities? I mean, it's just a terrible environment to do that sort of work, and it hasn't been tested. It has not been field tested. So why would you take something like that to Mars without it having been field tested on somewhere like the moon? So, I mean, I think the moon is the solution. You go to the moon. You go to Mars via the moon.
At ISDC, was there quite a bit of time devoted to the moon as the pathway to Mars, or was that not really a big issue there?
No, I wasn't there for very long. I was only there for the afternoon. I mean, the big conference for that was the Space Access Conference, which Doug Plato arranged in Phoenix earlier last month.
Right, and we've talked about that. So
that was very, very good. That was very well done.
So I want to switch over, but I want to come back to Mars and the moon. But I want to switch over to Virgin Galactic, because you did write the book and you've got the accident in the book. Are you hearing anything about may be in the accident report or anything like that? Are you getting any kind of rumors or any kind of information or glimpses of information?
Although Will Pomerantz was down at Space Access Society in Phoenix at the beginning of May. He gave a very good talk. And what Virgin Galactic, the mantra now is, we'll fly when they're ready. Before, they're always making these pronouncements, we're going to fly in 2008, we're going to fly in 2009, we're going to fly in 2010, but of course it never happened. So now, after the accident, they're just saying, we're going to fly when we're ready. And that's what X-Corp always used to say. I mean, you talk to Jeff Greeson, they'll say, look, it's best to be safe rather than sorry. That's their mantra. And so they've been plodding steadily along. You ask X-Corp when they're going to fly, and they say, look, we'll fly when we're ready. And that's what Virgin Galactic is saying now.
But you're not hearing anything that they may have to do to change their vehicle or anything like that through the report. You're not getting any inside information or rumors, are you?
No, there were a couple of questions directed at Will about that, but he wasn't able to answer those.
Are you optimistic that the company will survive and flourish as a result of this accident in the post-accident phase of the company's history? Are you bullish on them?
Well, they'll survive. I mean, they'll be successful. I think X-Corp will be first to market, first to fly revenue flights. The market is big enough for both Virgin Galactic and X-Corp, and I think Virgin Galactic will definitely be successful.
So you have no doubts about the market then?
Well, everybody has doubts because it's an unproven market. But if you believe the TARI organization, then it's potentially a pretty healthy market, because we're not talking about tourists, just tourists. The main revenue or the main source of revenue, I think, will come from research and scientists. That's really where the revenue stream will come. That when it kicks in.
What do you see, aside from the vehicle blowing up, what do you see as the major human risk factors on a suborbital flight?
Well, for the passengers, like the tourists off the street, it's a select-in process. the business wants to fly as many astronauts as possible. So if you're going to be a government astronaut, it's a select-out process. They're looking for reasons to disqualify you. It's the opposite for the commercial spaceflight business. So basically, a lot of these people, not a lot, but certainly a few, will have cardiovascular problems. And the G, so if you live a normal life, you can have all sorts of cardiovascular problems, relatively minor problems, but it won't affect you. But you put that person under G, who has a reasonably minor cardiovascular problem, 3G, 4G, that's going to exacerbate the problem, and that's where you have the problem. So the biggest worry, I think, is probably people with cardiovascular problems under G.
So I understand in the new commercial bill that the House has passed that they're reclassifying government astronauts and giving the title of government astronauts so that NASA can set safety standards for flying on the CST-100 and the Dragon. So are you up on that legislation that's pending?
Yeah, I haven't read the whole document yet, but I was aware of that's what they were doing. They were recalibrating the
Are you supportive of NASA setting safety standards for, quote, government astronauts? And then I wonder if there won't be any safety standards for civilian astronauts or space tourists, so to speak.
Well, that's NASA's job. I mean, NASA has to certify its astronauts, has to set standards for its own astronauts. I mean, that's part of its job, part of its mandate is to do that, the safety of its employees. And you look at the commercial spaceflight industry going back 10 years, I mean, when the CSLA amendment, sorry, when the amendment to the CSLA came about in 2004, then they were pretty much hands off. There were a lot of shoulds in the wording, and not many musts, because they wanted to allow the industry to develop. To their credit, X-Corps and Virgin Galactic, they went off on their own and developed their own standards because they wanted to ensure the safety of their passengers, because it doesn't help any industry if the passengers are killed. So you obviously have to have standards there to ensure passenger safety and crew safety, and also ensure flight operations are conducted safely as well.
Doug sent in another email for you. Actually, Jim Logan does mention 10 meters of water to get down to the sea level of radiation. But he says that amount is necessary in the surface of Mars for long-term settlement rather than during the much briefer transit phase. 7 meters of Martian dirt is the equivalent of 10 meters of water because of the great density of dirt. However, as Eric points out, one would only need half of that to receive the same level of radiation protection at 18,000 feet on Earth. And there are high-altitude towns on Earth where people are born, grow up, marry, and have kids and retire, so that amount of shielding on Mars would be more than sufficient. You think that would be more than sufficient, Eric?
Yeah, it would be sufficient. It's just it's getting that regolith on top of the habitat. And the other thing is all these artist renditioned images that we see of astronauts wandering around the surface. It's not going to be like that. They're going to be cave dwellers. They're going to be living underground. You're not going to see the astronauts for maybe more than half an hour a day, because they're going to get a radiation hit. They can't survive on the surface for much longer than that. So, I mean, people really have to recalibrate their notion of what it is to explore the moon and explore Mars, because they're going to be maintenance workers living deep, deep underground, just like these miners are in the Andes and places like that. And every once in a while, they're going to pop their head out and have a look around and then scurry back into their caves, because that's the reality of the radiation environment there.
Did you see the Mars travel posters that SpaceX has created?
SpaceX?
Yeah, SpaceX created a series of Mars travel posters.
I haven't seen them.
That you can Google and do a search for on the Internet. So they're actually really cool travel posters, but not very realistic. We talked about them on our open line show yesterday. I mean, one of them has a guy and a gal without wearing spacesuits standing, I think it's on one of the moons of Mars, holding hands, looking at a gorgeous sight of Mars close up because the moon is so close to Mars, and they're not wearing a spacesuit or anything like that. But so it's not going to be like that for sure, but they're really cool travel posters. I'd love to have a couple of them hanging on my wall. But when you get a chance, Google Mars travel posters by SpaceX.
I will. I just wrote the book about Dragon. That's coming out next. I'm actually writing about the Mars Colonial Transporter, which is Elon Musk's vision of how we're going to get to Mars. So that's the final chapter in the book.
Well, speaking of that, then how is that going to shield going to Mars for radiation?
I don't know, because there are no details available. Elon Musk is going to make an announcement at the end of the year about his vision of how we're going to get to Mars. And until then, it's under wraps. I mean, I've spoken with at least half a dozen SpaceX employees. I tried to tease information out of them. I said, look, do you have any information at all about Elon Musk's vision of how we're going to get to Mars? And they said, no, I'm sorry, we can't.
Well, do they know it and they just can't talk? They're sworn to secrecy, or do they not know?
Well, there's one who seemed to, well, there's one I spoke to at the Space Access Conference who said he had an idea, but he wasn't able to divulge that information.
Well, I'm sure they'd get sacked if they...
They would, yeah.
Yeah, if they, you know, spoke out of turn about it. There's no doubt about that.
Yeah.
Do you know if anyone is... consulting with them on human factors, any of your peers in the industry, or have you heard of that at all?
No, it's not so much human factors, it's propulsion and landing. I mean, SpaceX is one of the few companies who are actually going the extra mile in terms of figuring out the EDL problem. I mean, I think if any company solves it, it will be SpaceX. I mean, they're the one company who will solve the EDL problem for Mars, I think.
Do you think SpaceX will be able to jumpstart and hasten up a timeline to Mars? The one you gave me, you know, is pretty long. So do you think if SpaceX really does build the MCT and all of that, do you think they'll shorten that timeline?
Well, I hope so, because Elon Musk says he wants to go to Mars before he dies. So that gives you a window based on the average life expectancy of people in, you know, in North America. So
well,
if anybody can do it, I'd put money on Elon Musk.
More so than NASA?
Yeah, absolutely. A government program is, I think any government program would be doing well to celebrate the moon landing in 2069. That's probably a reasonable time frame for a government Mars mission.
Ben is in Seattle, Washington, with an email question. I understand there is a competitive group that has started up out of one of the Middle Eastern countries to compete against Mars One. They're called Polar Mars, I believe. Did you run across them at ISDC, or do you know anything about them?
I was only at ISDC for one day. I mean, these conferences are expensive, so I was invited as a speaker, which meant I didn't have to pay for the conference fee for that day. No, I didn't run into them, but I'll be writing about them because that's a fantastic book subject for people to read about.
Is there any information available on this new group that you've come across?
There's not much, no. But, I mean, it's possible to network through the Mars One. There's a Facebook site on I think, Aspiring Mars,
uh-huh.
I think it's called. And a lot of people there you can network through. You can get information through people on the network.
And you have a Mars One book that you're working on as well.
It's a proposal, yeah.
When would that come out?
End of the year. It'll be finished by the end of the year. It'll be published early next year. Because the Mars One are publishing a book in February next year, which promotes Mars One. Basically, my book is sort of not promoting it, sort of debunking a lot of the technology.
Yeah, I know, because I read your stuff that Praxis sent me as a reviewer of your book.
Yeah.
And I already sent my information back to him.
Yeah, thanks for that. They're reviewing that right now.
I pretty much... You know, I was pretty much a clone of what you were saying and talked about how the book was really needed. No surprises there, right?
No.
So there's a book coming out next year about Mars One that is supporting it?
Yeah, it's written by Norbert Kraft, who's the medical doctor for Mars One.
Have you ever met or talked with him?
Well, I was interviewed by him.
And he must have completely different perspectives than you do.
Well, he's paid by Mars One to promote Mars One, so he's a doctor, so I mean, obviously he understands the risks, but he's paid by Mars One to promote the agenda, to promote the mission, so obviously he's going to play down those risks.
Jack in Dallas, Texas. David, I'm listening to the show at work, so you know the drill. I got to use email. So here's my question. Eric, I know you're in Canada, and I know you're not here in the United States, but... if you were in the United States and you were actively going to Congress with one of these groups or several of these groups or trying to influence Congress on U.S. space policy, what would be your chosen U.S. space policy for human spaceflight?
As I said before, Mars via the Moon, that's responsible because you're using the Moon as a test bed to prove the technologies or to field test the technologies that you can then use for Mars as a stepping stone. And it's more financially viable. Because if you try to jumpstart all the technology, or you're trying to resolve all the technology to go to Mars in one big go, in a Battlestar Galactica approach, it's just going to be too much. And there's no Congress is going to sign off on that.
How do you know when you're ready to go to Mars by going to the Moon? So you're saying Mars via the Moon. How do you know when you've had enough of the Moon and you're ready to go to Mars?
Well, you need you can get data sets from the people who've spent time on the Moon. I mean, the first missions will be a few days, a few weeks, and then you extend to a few months. My idea is to do a Mars simulation. So you recruit four people. I mean, we know there's plenty of people who are going to volunteer for this. So if you look at the 200,000 people who applied for Mars 1, so you recruit four crew members. You send them into lunar orbit. They go around the Moon for 6 months to simulate the journey to Mars. Then you land them on the Moon. They spend a year on the Moon. And they go back into lunar orbit, spend another 6 months to simulate the journey back from Mars to Earth, and then you put them in a research lab and study them as guinea pigs and see how they survived, if they survived. That's the Mars analog mission right there.
That's a long time, Eric.
Yeah, but then you have at least four data points. It's similar to a 1,000-day Mars mission. But you look at most of the Mars mission architectures, most of them about 1,000 days long.
Is there anyone talking about such a mission?
No, but I described it in my book. I suggested it in my book, Mars via the Moon, and I suggested, look, if you really want to do a Mars analog mission, forget about these Mars 500 analog missions. Do a real one, and I mean, we're sort of halfway there. Well, not halfway, but a third of the way there with Scott Kelly and Kornienko up there right now on their one-year mission. But it's not in deep space. They're in low Earth orbit. They're protected from the worst of the radiation.
Right.
We're not going to learn that much more from that one-year mission.
No, but they would orbiting the Moon like you suggest. I think that's an interesting idea. You'd have no shortage of takers to volunteer for that, that's for sure.
No, we know that. That's, like I say, it wouldn't be that expensive. And right, then you get the answers. Okay, well, how do they adapt back to Earth gravity after 1,000 days in reduced gravity? Do they recover their muscle mass? I mean, we just don't know this.
Absolutely. We're at the halfway point, so I'm going to put us on break. And listeners, we'll be back in a couple of minutes. And you can give us a call. Not everyone out there is probably working. So those of you that have access to the phone, give us a call. 1-866-687-7223. Remember, I do answer the phone during the break. And then email, of course, drspace@thespaceshow.com. Back in 3 minutes with more of your questions for Dr. Eric Seedhouse.
The Space Show thanks its listeners for their generous support. The Space Show now joins forces with the One Giant Leap Foundation to further advance space education and the establishment of a spacefaring society and culture in America and the world. One Giant Leap Foundation is a tax-exempt organization with the purpose of advancing space education and development along with the Space Show. Your support of the Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation helps get the word out as to why space is so essential and important to us all. So join with us by going to www.thespaceshow.com and clicking on the Support the Space Show button. Your contribution will help the Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation in continuing its work and bringing you the programming you want free of charge on a continued basis. And remember, your gift to the Space Show is tax deductible.
I'm Dr. David Livingston, creator and host of the Space Show, and I would like to share my vision with you for not only this radio program, but for space development. Space should be like any other place we choose to visit, work in, or call our home. It should be just another destination, like Tahiti, Hawaii, or any place available to us right now on Earth. When this vision becomes reality, We will be spacefaring in our culture, our economy, our society, and in our lives. Our world will be vastly improved by countless space-related benefits, transforming our lives both in space and right here on Earth. And the Space Show is helping to make this vision a global reality. And welcome back, everybody. Part two of our Space Show program. Our guest today, Dr. Eric Seedhouse. We have caller John from Florida on the phone to ask you some questions, Eric. So go ahead, John.
Yes, I've been very surprised by the tremendous delay after Spaceship One. You know, I expect the big aerospace companies, big giant ones, to have giant cost overruns and take 10 or 20 years to get stuff done anymore. They used to be much better. But Burt Rutan is fantastic. You know, he usually gets things out very quickly, and they work better than their target specifications, and they're real cheap. So how did this happen that that group kind of got bogged down like a operating, I guess, more like a big aerospace dinosaur?
Well, don't forget, this is the first time anybody's ever tried to do this. I mean, it's a private enterprise. It's not government. So they're pretty much making it up as they go along. So the first flight, the first three suborbital flights, of Spaceship One. Those were test flights with very, very experienced pilots. I mean, Brian Binney and Mike Melville are very experienced test pilots. All of a sudden, you have to scale that spacecraft up to carry six passengers and fly them safely, because just imagine the disaster if something were to happen and you end up killing Justin Bieber or Paris Hilton. I mean, it'd be all over the press, and that would be the death of the industry. So they have to really increase the safety component of that spacecraft. And then in 2007, they had that accident with the cold flow test, which killed three CR Composites workers and I think injured 13 others. Well, that set them back. Now, that was in 2007. And then they have to wait for their reentry license, because you can't do these tests unless you have a reentry license. You have to have an experimental launch license from the FAA, then you have to have a reentry license. And they still haven't got the license to fly passengers. They still hadn't had that at the time of the Spaceship Two accident last year. So it's sort of been a mix of technology, safety, and legislation and regulation, which has sort of held them back. And they'll get there. It is frustrating. There have been some passengers who've asked for their deposit back and asked for a full refund, and that has happened. But generally, even after the accident, I think they only lost about 10 or 12 people. So there's a lot of confidence in them, and they will get there. It just may take some time.
Well, my understanding now is Rutan himself is retired, but did he sort of pull back from the project after a few years, personally?
Yeah, I mean, he'd been in the Mojave for, I think, 32 years, 35 years. I mean, the guy's a genius. I mean, he developed or designed 22 or more aircraft, experimental aircraft, none of which had a single failure. I mean, the guy's had a fantastic record, but, I mean, enough is enough. After such a long time in the Mojave, I think he just decided, you know, he's done his work, basically, and he retired to his ranch in Idaho.
He sold Scale, too, so don't forget that. And it did become a major aerospace corporation business.
Yeah, to Northrop Grumman.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Well, I was about to mention that. That also, I guess what I see this as is maybe it's a case study where someone could look at it and try to examine why it is, this being a case study of the more general phenomena that our aerospace industry has become much, much, much slower and much, much more expensive and less innovative all at the same time. I mean, if you look at the earlier years, if you look at when, let's say, jet engines first came around, or really when we got into liquid rocket engines, you know, the progress was amazingly rapid just after World War II in doing things like producing jet fighter planes and then producing even jet airliners. I mean, if you look at the circa 1955 airliners, essentially, let's say, a 707 type airframe, in most respects, that's the type of airliner we fly in today. If you had a 1955 707 model flying around an airport, probably the only thing that would make it stick out is that the turbojet versus turbofan engines would look a little bit small. You know, they're a little bit narrow in diameter, but it would basically look like a modern jet airplane. So I thought it was a remarkable contrast between how well and how quickly the Spaceship One was developed versus this incredible delay afterwards.
Eric, can I jump on you for a minute and say something about this?
Yeah.
Because I used to deliver, when I first started the space show, I delivered a lot of papers, and I haven't done it in a long, long time, and I don't know whether I want to get back into the business of doing it or not. But one of the most fundamental mistakes is the one that you're making right now, John, and that is to draw a comparison between jet airplane engines and development and rockets, because they are not similar. And a rocket is not a jet engine, and the differences between them, the risk factors, how they work, the danger factors, the fuels, everything about them are really not comparable. And with jets, you have literally millions of hours of flight history on a jet engine and various jet engines. You barely have 60 or 70 launches of rockets a year. There's a service that I subscribe to that tells you every single rocket that's ever been launched, including ones that didn't make it. And you can look up and see the total number. I mean, I think the last time I looked it up, it's only, you know, in the mid-hundreds. To try to compare the progress with aviation and jet engines to working with rockets, it's a big apples and oranges. It just doesn't fit.
Well, let me shift away from the comparison between jets and rockets. Whether you're talking about jets or rockets, the aerospace industry in general has been this way. The same pattern has happened within rocket development. The rocket development happened much more quickly, much more rapidly.
And it reached its peak because there's not much more you can do with a chemical rocket today. There aren't any exotic fuels. There aren't any unobtainium metals that are going to significantly reduce the mass of a rocket. The rocket equation isn't evolving over time into something different than what it is. And trying to come up with advanced propulsion is a real bitch. And while nuclear, we got close to it, you know, years and years and years ago, for whatever reason, we can't seem to get it on track to put it together again. And I don't know anyone who is not supportive of nuclear propulsion, but it just doesn't happen. And the research dollars for it are few and far between. And you can't get blood out of the turnip, and the chemical rockets are pretty much at their max. So SpaceX makes progress on lowering the launch costs because, number one, they didn't start with any legacy infrastructure. So they control their integration of manufacturing, and they believe vertical is the very best way to go on that. So that means everything is that they need is produced and controlled in-house. The next thing that they do is they're highly, highly computerized. So that their manufacturing processes, their welding, everything they do is the most modern that there is. It's software-driven, and it's as less labor-intensive as it can possibly be made in 2015. And that's how they're lowering, launch costs. That they're not getting any better mass payload ratios than an Atlas V.
Let me sign off here, but the one last thing I want to say is in the case of Virgin Galactic, it's sort of amazing because the Spaceship One, getting from zero to Spaceship One, was a remarkable achievement, and it was done very quickly and very well. But then all that needed to be done, now it's non-trivial, but all you had to do from there was scale the basic design up, make it bigger, and make it safe and reliable. And so we've had this.
But they went down the rabbit hole trying to scale up a hybrid rocket engine. And that technically has really probably cost them big time. And But X-Corps is not going that route, and I don't know that X-Corps is short of money. I mean, they're not rolling in dough. But, you know, it's very hard for them to do it, despite the fact that suborbital was done, you know, 5 decades ago. So in a sense, they're reinventing the wheel. This is not the first time anyone's ever flown suborbital. I think Virgin really went down the rabbit hole trying to scale up the hybrid rocket engine, and that has cost them dearly and probably is a factor in the accident, although who knows if that'll come out that way or not. Eric, I jumped all over you, and you were going to say some things, so you might as well enter because I've pretty much said what I had to say. I think there are reasons for these delays since Spaceship One. It's extremely hard for these companies to do it. They can't do it with propulsion out of hybrid rocket engines, and X-Corps has been trying as hard as they can to get it going, and I don't know that funding's a big issue on the X-Corps side. Maybe it is, but you can't squeeze much more performance out of a chemical rocket.
Let me sign off in case someone else...
You may want to hear what Eric has to say and see if you want to respond to him. Eric, do you have anything you want to add to any of this?
Yeah, I mean, the answer I gave was just a synopsis. I mean, Virgin Galactic had all sorts of problems, just like any space company has. I mean, look at SpaceX. But they were written off dozens of times before they succeeded. And like I say, I just gave you a snapshot of some of the problems they had. For example, just last year they had cracks in the spars. Those spars were connecting with the fuselage, so basically they had to investigate the cause of the cracks because you can't have a spaceship going into suborbital space when you've got cracks in the fuselage. So they found out it was the result of the rubber nitrous oxide engine.
The vibrations of it, yeah.
So that was causing vibration. The vibration was causing the crack, so they had to backtrack and sort out the problem. So they ended up with hydroxyl terminated polybutadiene. So HTPB, which they're burning now, which is a sort of benign thermoplastic fuel. I mean, it's just one example of a long series of problems they had. And like I say, it's not easy. There have been 7 suborbital flights in history ever. That's it. And that's all the experience that you have when you're building these things. And when we're talking about cost, I mean, the whole budget up to date is only around $400 million, which sounds like a lot, but compare that to a government enterprise. I mean, that's just a drop in the tank. So to get to where they are on $400 million, it's been 11 years, but they've done well. I mean, they're doing the best they can with the resources they have and the money they have. It's not like they have unlimited funding here. It's not like a government enterprise. So you just really have to give them time.
I think they would have done better if they hadn't tried to scale up the hybrid rocket engine.
I mean, yeah, they probably agree with you, but like at the time, they probably pressed on too far with that.
Yeah. John, what else is on your mind?
Well, that was really, I'd love to ask about the Mars Colonial Transport, but that already came up, and Eric said he nothing's out there yet, so I guess that's about it, but pleasure talking, and let me sign off here so other people, if anybody else needs to call in.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks.
You had another radiation email from Doug. He's on a roll here with radiation. Eric is correct that EVAs on Mars would be exposed to greater radiation. So the total amount of EVA time would need to be within a radiation budget. However, the EVA rovers could have a cabin with 50 centimeters of shielding, such as local water. Since the mass of Mars is already blocking 50% of space radiation, and the shielded cabin would reduce galactic cosmic radiation by about 2/3, and nearly all of the sun's cosmic radiation in such a vehicle would reduce the overall radiation exposure down to about 12% of the amount of radiation in free space, or specifically about 0.23 millisieverts per day. At this rate, it would take up about 105,000 hours of EVAs before reaching a 1,000 millisievert career limit for a typical male astronaut. So by using the correct amount and type of shielding in each phase of a Mars mission, the risk of radiation ought to be able to be managed. And then he gives a NASA radiation shielding graph for reference, and the URL is too long to give out.
So. Yeah, he's right. But what I mentioned were the artist renditions of astronauts wandering around unprotected. I mean, sure, you can go in a rover, but that's that's an EVA, but it's not the EVA most people envision when they think of exploring the moon or exploring Mars.
But then there are other human factors on going into deep space and going to Mars and stuff like that you haven't even addressed yet. I don't know if you want to go into them. I mean, you mentioned a litany of them as the show was starting, with vision and microgravity and other kinds of issues like that. So radiation is a big one, but it's not the only one.
Well, no, I mean, another book of mine that's coming out is the vision impairment problem. So it's the NASA acronym is Vision Impairment Intracranial Pressure, or VIIP. And so one of my colleagues, he's the leader of the task force for this, because it's such a problem that NASA set up a task force in 2011 to investigate this. So we know that astronauts on long-duration missions have vision impairment problems, about 25%, 26% of them, all male, all over the age of 45. Some of them can't even read checklists during their mission, so they have to have space adaptation glasses, which they take along now to actually rectify the problem. There's no smoking gun. NASA has a reasonable idea of what it might be, but there's no solution to it. And then compounding that, if you send these astronauts into deep space, you have the radiation component. We know for a fact that a lot of the Apollo astronauts, who, by the way, only spent a few days in deep space, not several weeks or several months, they came back and they developed cataracts. Cataracts is a vision, a radiation-induced vision problem. So now imagine you've got the vision impairment intracranial pressure problem compounding that you have cataracts. So there's a reasonable expectation that some of those astronauts could get to the surface of Mars and be legally blind. Now, do you really want a legally blind crew on a multi-billion dollar mission? Because that's the reality of just that one single physiological problem. And we can spend a whole program about this on each individual physiological problem, but that's just one. And add that to the radiation problem, add it to the bone demineralization problem, add it to the muscle atrophy problem, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And you've got a pretty discombobulated crew by the time you get to Mars.
I've had the PIs of the vision work on the show before, so habitual space show listeners are well familiar with that. And, Eric, I have cataracts, and I haven't been subject to radiation, so how the hell did I get them?
Good question.
You can tell me it's old age?
Well, it is age-related once you get my father had cataracts as well.
Was he subjected to radiation?
No.
Yeah, so... but you wouldn't want to put me in space. It would probably facilitate them. Well, my vision would deteriorate quickly, so I'd qualify for the Medicare surgery faster than what I'm qualifying for. So there might be one bright side to that.
Yeah, the silver lining.
the silver lining, right. And they did talk, when I had the guys on who were working the vision experience, they did talk about space adaptation glasses, and they said they're okay, but they're not really great. And you know what? I now see them for sale in these magazine ads and TV infomercials for adjustable vision glasses. Have you seen this?
No.
So you can adjust the prescription in your lens with these glasses so that you don't have to go buy different glasses every time your prescription changes. You can just dial in a different prescription on your glasses. So, well, whether they work or not is another story. I looked up the Amazon reviews on them, and they weren't very hot. So I decided not to do that. Are you forgiving of these time delays with suborbital spaceflight? Do you rationalize it away, or do you think the companies could have performed better somehow, sort of looking at hindsight, even though we still don't have them flying yet? Are you pretty forgiving and understanding, or do you think they could have done a lot better?
No, I think, when you talk to people like Jeff Greason, I mean, these are the most optimistic people you're ever going to meet. I mean, these guys went without salaries for years because they believed in the vision of commercial spaceflight. And so we should really get down on our hands and knees and thank these guys, because without them, there wouldn't be an industry. And yeah, you can criticize it all you want, but I mean, when you're on the front line in the Mojave and building these spaceships in wooden hangars on a shoestring budget, I mean, it's going to be tough. It's very, very tough. And like I say, thank God we have companies like Virgin Galactic and X-Corp doing this, because without it, commercial spaceflight would be much more poorer for it.
I'm pretty understanding, and I think if there's a culprit in the delays, like John was talking about, the culprit or the blame lies with people who somehow, and this is throughout space cadet land, but also the space industry land, have unreasonable expectations of timelines and ease and success for this industry, because it is not easy, it is very costly, and it is very, very challenging. And many of us have had unreasonable expectations since the days of Apollo, since we thought we were going to Mars, right after Apollo. And we thought we were entitled to Mars on a silver platter. And we're still not there, and not even really that close. And I think people who thought right after Spaceship One flew would just be a couple of years before, space tourism started. It was always 2 years away, right? And that's just an unreasonable expectation and not understanding what the task involved. Now, did the companies help to produce that kind of unreasonable expectation, and the advocacy organizations maybe to some degree? You know, they helped promote unreasonable expectations, but they've certainly got more realistic as time went on. I remember I was at an ISDC in Washington, D.C., and Elon Musk gave a talk, and I don't remember the year, but it was, 5 years ago, maybe 6 years ago. And in that talk, he said, and you can find it on the internet, he said that you need to discard everything he has said about space and the progress they would make up until this minute, because it was all wrong. And it's much harder than he ever thought, and much more challenging, and nothing he said before matters anymore. And so I think he was taking ownership of rhetoric that produces unrealistic expectations, but no more. He had learned his lesson. And again, you can find that ISDC talk of his on the web. I had a friend search for it in a paper they were writing, and I gave him the references for it, but I don't remember what they are, and he found the paper and the exact quote. So it's out there. So that's how I see it. So, John, if you're still listening, I would not say... I would not point to the companies for the delays. I would, if anything, I think the companies may have contributed to rhetoric that encourages all of us to have unreasonable expectations. But our unreasonable expectations are largely our own doing, because we haven't wanted to deal with the facts, just like you're talking about the facts of radiation on Mars.
That's right.
So that's my rant for the day, Eric. Are you... happy or satisfied with the regulatory process that is so far playing out in commercial space? I know there are efforts underway to maybe regulate lunar and asteroid mining. We've all seen the articles about that and heard about things like that. We know there's disputes on the commercial space bill that the House just passed. They go down party lines. Michael Listener did a real good job in explaining them yesterday, a lot having to do with liabilities of the company. But basically, it's still, according to the 2004 Commercial Space Launch Act, which is hands-off short of, a major commercial accident or third-party injury or something like that, which has not yet been deemed to have happened. So are you okay with the pace of regulation and the hands-off? Do you think that's still needed?
Yeah, because the intent with the hands-off approach was to encourage the industry, and you can't encourage the industry if you over-regulate it. And to their credit, the FAA AST did a very good job with that regulation. I mean, if anything, they were too lenient. And that's why the operators themselves stepped in and develop their own procedures, because, as I said before, it's in nobody's interest to kill a passenger. I mean, if you kill a passenger, then that's a big, big body blow for the industry. So it's in the interest of the operators to be as safe as possible, make their flight operations as safe as possible, make their training as safe as possible, to make sure their medical certification only certifies those people who are safe to fly. So, yeah, I think on balance, they've done a very good job. I think when the industry starts, once we have a few flights under our belt, passenger space tourism flights, and also research flights and science flights, then I think you may see the regulations, more regulations coming in, because until you start flying, you can't really anticipate all the problems.
I know you wanted to address the actual definition of space, and there are some issues around that. So let's take this opportunity to go on into the definition of space, okay?
Yeah, so the Fédération Aéronautique Internationale, that's the FAI, they provide the records for aeronautics, whether it's flying around the world or whether it's going into space. And the definition of flight, which is the internationally accepted definition of space, is 100 kilometers or 100,000 meters or 328,000 feet. And that was the altitude that Spaceship One had to go to twice in 2 weeks to get the XPRIZE. Now, if you look at the small print on your Virgin Galactic ticket, in case anybody's listening who's got a Virgin Galactic ticket, it will say that the company only guarantees you to get to 50 miles or 80,000 kilometers, sorry, 80,000 meters or 80 kilometers altitude. And to most people, that's not space. In the 1960s, the X-15 pilots, some of those, Joe Walker, for example, got his astronaut wings from NASA because he flew over 50 miles altitude. But Virgin Galactic passengers are not military pilots. So they're still going to get astronaut wings. They won't be FAA astronaut wings. They won't be FAA commercial astronaut wings, because the only people who get those are the pilots who fly over 100 kilometers, like Brian Binney and Mike Melville did. So there's a little bit of interpretation there in terms of what constitutes space. Some of the flights may well end up going over 100 kilometers altitude, but the guarantee is for you only to get above 50 miles. So if you really want to get to above 100 kilometers, then I suggest you go with some passengers who are very light.
Go with some passengers who are very light. That's an interesting comment. Do you think that this has sunk in on passengers yet, or do you think that when they find out that they're making it to 50 kilometers and that's it, there's going to be a lot of PO'd people?
I don't think it has sunk in, because most people aren't aware of this. And for most of the passengers who've bought tickets, it's a thrill ride. So they don't really care. I mean, they get the thrill of going up to 50 miles. Afterwards, they have the big party. They get the astronaut wings, drink lots of champagne, and off they go. That's the bucket list item checked off. There will be some people who really want to go into space. If they really, really want to go into space, then, as I said before, make sure you've got some people who don't weigh too much, or go the X-Core route. But like I say, that's the guarantee on the ticket is 50 miles. That's not space in most people's books.
I have a note on suborbitals. I'm assuming I'm permitted to read this on air. Suborbital launch systems have taken far too long, particularly as they have been highly funded. The companies that had the most success, including Beyond Earth, with 6 launches, were forced out of business. The delays are on purpose and designed to clear the field. SpaceX has been highly funded since its inception, as well as Blue Origin. It is not like they have suffered. So crying the poor, poor, poor billionaires just does not fly. Any comments on that, Eric?
Well, up to now, SpaceX and Blue Origin, they were working on unmanned vehicles. I mean, I know SpaceX is man rating their Dragon V2, which is going to be the vehicle that carries astronauts to the ISS at the end of 2016, beginning of 2017. But they're commercial. They have Space Act agreements. They get funding to the tune of billions of dollars from NASA. So pretty much 80% of SpaceX's funding was government funding for the development of the Dragon. And Virgin Galactic, X-Core, they are privately funded enterprises. They rely on venture capitalists and angel investors. That's it. That's where they get the money. Every once in a while, they'll have a contract with the military, maybe, which is what happened with X-Core a few years ago. But for the most part, they rely on the generosity of venture capitalists and angel investors. And it's a tough to attract those sort of people, because there's no industry yet. Nobody's flown a revenue flight. And so investors are hesitant to plow in, you know, tens of millions of dollars, which is what these companies need to realize their goal of revenue flights, without knowing what the return on investment is going to be, because that's the bottom line. That's what these angel investors want. They want to make money at the end of the day. Government, at the end of the day, doesn't have that mindset. So they have these Space Act agreements. They give SpaceX $2.6 billion. They give Boeing another $2.8 billion or $4.2 billion or whatever it was to develop their vehicles. Whereas, the companies we're talking about here, it's completely at the other end of the spectrum. I mean, they're relying on handouts from, private investors. And so it's not really, you can't really make the comparison there.
I've spoken to George Whitesides about this issue more than I have Jeff at X-Corp. But George, on many, many times, including on his space show appearances, has made a very clear point of saying they don't have any government money coming into their operation. So whether Branson is getting money from outside the country, and I guess he did get the Abu Dhabi Investment Group to buy into it a couple of years ago, but there is no subsidy money coming into Virgin, and I doubt that there is any going into X-Corp. I'm not so sure about Blue Origin because they've been competing in some of the COTS work and have been unfunded and I think have been funded, although I'm not 100% clear on that. But I agree with you. I don't think there's any government funding going into these suborbital companies, these two of them. Now, there are suborbital companies that can't even talk in Europe. There's Swiss Space. There's another group out of Copenhagen called Copenhagen Suborbitals or something like that. And there's another couple of groups, I think, in England that are trying to build suborbital vehicles. The big one in England that's not suborbital with the technology, with Alan Bond. What's the name of the company?
That's Reaction Engine.
Yeah, Reaction Engine. So they want government funding to help them with their program with Reaction Engine. But I don't think that's a suborbital vehicle. I think they're ultimately wanting to build orbital space
planes.
That's
right. And they did get the funding. They got quite a chunk of money in the end.
I don't know what Swiss Space is getting. I think they have private investors. I've been wanting to do a show with Swiss Space, but talk about delays, that always gets delayed. And some of the other companies I haven't really attempted to get much more information on, but they do exist. So I don't think, what I guess I'm trying to say is that there's no super-duper technology that any of these companies have that give them an advantage over any others. I think if somebody had a clear path to suborbital flight that was superior and could get them into flight really, really fast, you would see it, given that there are players from outside the United States attempting to do this too. But everybody seems to be moving at give or take the same pace. And so I just can't see this being a technology issue because if there was better technology out there to do it, I think one of these players would grasp it. I don't know. Maybe I'm wrong because I'm not a technology guy, but that's kind of how I see it. Everybody's kind of stuck at the same pace and the same level, aren't they?
Yeah, and I think part of it is funding. It's just very, very tough getting the funding.
Well, funding and maybe it's the quality of their engineering and their designs. I don't know, but if somebody had the magic material and the magic fuel and the magic this and that to make this work really, really fast and to bypass all these learning curves that everyone seems to be going through, I think we would see it, and we're not seeing it. So,
not like I say, you have to play the patience game.
That's why the what?
Have to play the patience game. That's what they're doing. That's all they can do.
What else is on your agenda that you wanted to talk about? I know you you did want to be sure and address the definition of space. X-Corp doesn't go to space in the Lynx 1, so it's not a big issue for them. They haven't marketed that they're going to take you to space. I think they go to 2/3 the distance to space on Lynx 1.
Well, that's the Mark 1, yeah. So the X-Corp version, Mark 1 Lynx, is going to go to 61,000 meters, about 200,000 feet. That's going to give you about a minute and a half of zero-G. And then in parallel, with the flight testing of the Mark 1, they're going to develop the Mark 2, and the Mark 2 will take you to suborbital space. So that will take you to 100 kilometers, and then in parallel with the development and the flight testing of the Mark 2, they will develop the Mark 3, which is the one that has the pod on the top, so they can actually send or deploy satellites from the pod.
So
that's their plan.
Do you see... Is Mars really, in your opinion, the holy grail for human spaceflight? Do you think that that's an exaggeration? Because that's what everybody says. That's the brass ring that human spaceflight is supposed to reach out to. It depends on who you talk to. It's either the brass ring is either space settlement or it's humans on Mars. So where do you come down here?
Yeah, I'm all for the bold endeavor. I come from Norway, and we have a rich tradition of explorers. I mean, Amundsen, Nansen, Sverdrup, all these guys, they went out first to the South Pole, first to the Northwest Passage. I mean, those were bold endeavors back in those days. It was on the same level as a Mars mission 100 years ago to pull off some of these exploration goals. So I'm all for the bold endeavor. I mean, yeah, the moon is old news. I know that. But it's a means to an end if it achieves the ultimate goal, which is, blueprints on Mars.
So you think the ultimate goal is humans on Mars?
Well, in the near term, I mean, with the technology that we have, I mean, when we start developing technology like human hibernation, which is ongoing, by the way, I mean, the European Space Agency is developing this. I actually have one of my authors for the major reference work that we're writing for the life support system. He's actually writing a chapter on this human hibernation experiment that they're doing. So once we get human hibernation developed, then we can strike out further. But in the near term, in the next 30 to 40 years, that's the horizon that we're looking at for getting a manned mission to Mars, then that should be the goal.
Chris is in Memphis, and I think this Chris is a she, because she says, I'm at work listening to the show with my fellow girlfriends, and I can't use the phone. But I'm confused, because I know that many of the space advocate organizations are now pushing priorities of cheaper access to space or lowering the cost to getting to space, along with space settlement. But I'm hearing Eric say that going to Mars is where the brass ring is. So, Eric, can you please clarify?
That we should go to the moon first to enable a journey to Mars. So the brass ring is Mars, but to realize that goal, you first have to go to the moon, use that as a test bed or a test platform for the technologies, and also to iron out the physiological challenges of going to Mars. So the vision is not to go to Mars in one big leap, but to take a small leap or a small leap first to the moon, and then the giant leap to Mars.
Where does space settlement and lowering the cost of space access fit on your priority list?
Well, I think if the commercial entities such as Shackleton Energy Company and Golden Spike and all these enterprises are successful, then space settlement will happen as a byproduct of commercializing the moon. So we know that Shackleton Energy Company, they want to go to the moon and produce propellant for use in low Earth orbit. We know that the Chinese are going to go to the moon and mine helium-3. So if these commercial enterprises take off, which they probably will eventually, then a byproduct of that will be space settlement on the moon, because you need maintenance workers, you need people to fly the space tugs, and also you need the operators of the equipment. I mean, a lot of it will be automated, it will be robotic, but you still need the human element there for when things break down.
We're getting pretty close to the end of the program today. What do you think are the salient concluding comments here or takeaways that we should hold on to?
It's just recalibrate your expectations. Don't believe everything you read in the media, because if you read popular science and popular mechanics all the time, then you're going to be led to believe that suborbital flight is going to happen next year, and I'm not. You're going to be led to believe that a manned mission to Mars is going to happen by the end of the next decade. It's not. So you just really have to calibrate your expectations, get a grip of the technology that we have and what's realizable in the next 10, 15 years time frame, and understand the challenges, the physiological challenges, and just, put that in perspective, basically. Really put expectations in perspective of what they're doing, what the commercial companies are doing, like X-Corp and Virgin Galactic, is very, very tough, especially on the limited budgets that they have. And like I said, they'll fly when they're ready. And when that might be, we really don't know. Hopefully by the end of the decade.
So so you're not expecting suborbital tourism flights anytime in the next year or two?
No.
Wow.
Well, X-Corp, they'll start flight testing their Mark 1 this year. Jeff told me that he would be surprised if the flight testing took as little as 6 months. He said he would be surprised if it took longer than 18 months. That's the Mark 1. Now, they're going to develop the Mark 2 in parallel. So, you know, if they were start flight testing later this year, then we're looking into 2017 by the time they finish flight testing. That's the Mark 1 parallel development. You may, you know, looking at end of 2018, 2019, before you have the suborbital flights. Now you have to get your license from the FAA to fly passengers. And that's another administrative hurdle. So, realistically, you're probably not going to have revenue flights anytime before 2019, realistically.
It's a long ways off.
It is. Yeah.
2019.
That's a reasonable time frame, I think, for revenue flights to suborbit.
I don't think any of us like to hear that. But it is what it is, as the expression goes, right? Would you be surprised if anybody short-circuited that and got flying with revenue flights in 2016, 2017?
There'll be revenue flights, but the revenue flights will probably be on the Mark 1 X-Corp. And that's the suborbit. Sub-suborbit.
Well, yeah, but there could be revenue flights on Virgin Galactic if they get their act together and can do it. I mean, I don't know how long that's going to take them.
Yeah, I mean, first they have to build they have to finish spaceship two, and they're pretty close. Then they have to put the engine in it, start the flight testing, and then the flight testing, that's going to go through to 2017 at least, and then they have to start the long procedure of getting the license to fly passengers.
And this doesn't include any changes they're required to make because of the NTSB report that may come out.
Nothing, so we don't know the outcome of that yet either.
And they're not planning to, for the time being, as far as you know, to get rid of the hybrid engine, right?
Well, the engine, it's the HTPB engine. That's the fuel they're going to be using. I don't know about the engine.
Yeah. Well, that's the hybrid.
Yeah. That's the one they're going to be using, as far as I know.
Okay. Well, so you've got a whole series of books coming out, so I guess we'll have a whole series of shows with you over the coming months.
Yeah, I'll make sure Nora sends them down to you. The e-copy or the actual copy.
Yeah, so the next one is Dragon, coming out this summer, correct?
Yeah.
Is SpaceX helping you with that book, or is it a sort of an unauthorized view of Dragon?
Well, they gave me permission for some of the images just updated for the actual SpaceX book. But when you try and talk to people at SpaceX and trying to get some inside information, they just really stonewall you. They're very friendly. I mean, I've spoken with quite a few of them, but when you ask them for specifics, then they just say, look, we just can't comment on that.
So they keep it close, huh?
Yeah, not as close as Blue Origin. You know, I wanted to write a book about Blue Origin, but the thing about Blue Origin, you can't get any images. There are no NASA images. Every single Blue Origin image is Blue Origin copyright, so I sent them a letter. An email, rather, saying, look, I'd like to have permission to use some of your images. And they said, no, we can't do that.
So they wouldn't even let you use their images?
No, they won't. And that's not just me, it's just anybody who approaches them.
Well, I don't know what to say about that.
Well, unless the people listening on the show who took secret photos of Blue Origin spacecraft or Blue Origin...
contact Eric.
Contact
him and let him see what you've got. I guess they can't copyright those images, right?
No, they can't, no.
All right, my friend. We'll look forward to talking to you about the Dragon when that book is available. So please do have Nora contact me. And I don't know what happened with these other two books. I may have lost their emails. I just don't know.
Yeah, I'll do that.
Okay. I appreciate your coming on the show, and thank you very much, and we'll talk to you soon. Any chance you're going to make it down to Silicon Valley for the New Space Conference in July?
No, I can't, not unless they invited me.
With all these books you're writing, you can't travel to Silicon Valley? Come on, you're a famous author.
Yeah, I don't make that much money.
Well,
I mean, they pay me royalties, but at the end of the day, it's not a business where you make that much money.
You need a bestseller, like O'Reilly or something like that, you know?
Well, SpaceX is my bestseller. I mean, that sells a phenomenal number of books.
The SpaceX book?
That's my bestseller by a long shot, yeah.
Okay, that's interesting. All right, my friend, we will talk to you, into the summer about your Dragon book. I look forward to getting a copy of it and to talking to you again.
That sounds good, Debbie. Thanks again for having me on.
My pleasure. Listeners, Bob Zubrin is our guest tomorrow on the Space Show. So I understand he's primarily talking about the upcoming Mars Society conference, which has some just dynamic powerhouse speakers. I'm sure if I put him in a debate with Eric, some sparks would fly. But maybe you can listen and call in. I don't know if you can use a toll-free line from Canada or not.
I just do that, yeah.
But possibly it'll work. And then we have the rest of our stuff is Hotel Mars with Alan Stern on New Horizons Wednesday night. And then our Friday program and our Sunday program. So Greg Mihalik is on Friday, and he's talking about advanced space propulsion and a whole series of other related topics. And this is his field, and also what he does with AIAA and the AIAA groups as well. But he works at the Aerospace Corporation in Los Angeles. So that'll be a great guest, and looking forward to that. And then our Sunday Space Show program, and we're off to the races for the month of June. So everybody have a great week. Thanks for tuning in. Thanks to Dr. Eric Seedhouse for being with us today and all of you who called in and who emailed us. Goodbye, everyone. Thanks again from the Space Show.